That's Paolo Nutini and Coming Up Easy. Please say hello on Twitter, at Richard Serrett, at Richard Serrett, S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T, at Richard Serrett. And if you like what you hear, you might want to check out my weekly syndicated radio program that emanates out of Toronto. It's called The Conspiracy Show, and it airs on Zoomer Radio, which is a 50,000-watt clear-channel blowtorch station up here. The signal reaches way down into the United States, all the way down to the Carolinas, but I also have a growing list of affiliates. And for more information, you can check out my website, strangeplanet.ca, strangeplanet.ca. And you can also stream the show live on YouTube. The YouTube channel is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Please hit the subscribe button. A sci-fi staple for decades, laser weapons are finally becoming reality in the U.S. military, albeit with capabilities a little less dramatic than at the movies. Lightsabers, the favored weapon of the Jedi in Star Wars films, will remain in the fictional realm for now, but after decades of development, laser weapons are now here and are being deployed on military vehicles and planes. Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, all the big defense players are developing prototypes for the Pentagon. The Navy has, since 2014, been testing a 30-kilowatt laser on one of its warships, the USS Ponce. Lockheed Martin has just announced a 60-kilowatt laser weapon that soon will be installed in an Army truck for operational testing against mortars and small drones. The weapons can take out a drone from a distance of about 500 yards by keeping its beam locked onto the target for a few seconds. Jim Murdoch, an international business development director at Lockheed, told reporters this week. I mentioned I was going to keep you abreast of some of George Noy's upcoming live events. I mentioned the Total Health Show coming up here on April 22nd. But in Everett, Washington, at the Everett Theater, George will be there too. Radio to stage. Enjoy the grand experience. Danheiser-Wagner Entertainment brings the world's number one late-night radio show to the stage. Enjoy watching the host of Coast to Coast AM, Emmy Award winner George Noy, interview some of today's brightest experts in the world of ufology, paranormal, conspiracy, and all things unexplained. This three-hour stage show consists of interviews combined with video, music, and singing, which create an unforgettable experience for all theatergoers and fans of the hugely popular Coast to Coast AM radio show. That's George Noy live coming to the Everett Theater in Everett, Washington. That's in July. For more information, go to the coasttocoastam.com website, and up in the menu, you'll see George Noy Events. That's where you'll find everything you need to know. All right, back to more of your phone calls, questions, and comments for Don Jeffries, Survival of the Richest, right here on Coast to Coast AM. We are back with Don Jeffries, Survival of the Richest, How the Corruption of the Marketplace and the Disparity of Wealth Created the Greatest Conspiracy of All. Before we get back into the phone calls, you've been mentioning Huey Long a few times. The Kingfish was a governor of Louisiana back in the, late 20s and the early 30s, and then he was a senator. Was going to run for president and was assassinated. But tell me a little bit more of his program. Every man a king was his motto.
Every man a king and no one wears a crown. Yeah, he just took the country by storm. I believe Share Our Wealth Society, which he started, I believe had 10 million members at the time of his death. He was receiving more fan mail in the United States Senate than all the other senators put together, and more fan mail than any senator has ever received before or since. He was an incredible speaker, an incredible character. And if we had, in the era of television and the internet, I can't imagine what he would have been like. He was just a fascinating individual. He saw what was going on out there, and he was a genuine populist. He was for the little guys. That he never took a case against a poor man. He battled Standard Oil. He battled the big banks. He was an early critic of the Federal Reserve. He was against World War One. He was right on everything in my eyes, and he predicted his assassination, and it was predictable that he would be assassinated because he was going to run for president in 1936, and I think he would have won. And, unfortunately, he was assassinated, and I have a great deal on that in the book as well. It's a typical case where it was a cover up. It wasn't investigated properly, and so forth. And another good man, you know, was taken away from us without any kind of logical explanation making any sense.
Was there fear, though, at the time that Huey Long was a demagogue, could have become a dictator?
Well, yeah, that's exactly what was used against him. They kept calling him a demagogue, and that's a typical name that they will throw on people. I mean, I believe they said the same things about Trump. I don't put Trump in his category, but the garden variety corruption that they accused him of, the deduct box and so forth, you know, pales in comparison to virtually the corruption we see exposed with virtually every elected political leader we've had in the last century. So if he was corrupt, it was garden variety stuff. And I, you know, judging by, you know, the enemies he had and what he was trying to do, I certainly don't trust anything that was said about him, because, like I said, you can see the tangible results he received. That's why he's still beloved to this day. The poor of Louisiana. I mean, he turned the state from a swamp, you know, a thriving metropolis. And unlike all the other Southern politicians of his day, he never pandered to race. He wasn't anti-Semitic. They couldn't accuse him of anything. He just was against the rich hoarding all the wealth. And as such, obviously somebody like me is going to be attracted to him. He's my personal political hero.
The idea of being a populist these days, it's come under fire. Even the Pope is, you know, citing the dangers of populism. Populism means being concerned about ordinary people. I mean, obviously they make the allusions to Hitler. He was billed as a populist. But, I mean, putting that aside, and I know that's a big thing to put aside, but that's why do we fear populism?
Well, because populists might actually get something done. You know, that's what you, I mean, that's, instead they prefer to have this liberal, what they call liberals today, versus conservatives. And they know, for instance, that a liberal like an LBJ or a Clinton or Obama would just create another bureaucratic program, and the money will be diverted into avenues that's not productive, it's not efficient, and the problem doesn't get solved. Then it becomes, as you talked about, the homeless industry, and that this creates more industries. It creates, you know, the poverty industry and social workers, and it's a whole milieu there that just gets involved, and then they get into their own areas of corruption as well. But if you just simply had a rational tax system, which is what Huey Long wanted to do, you know, he wanted the first million to be exempt from tax. So basically, under the tax system, most of us wouldn't be paying any taxes at all. And it would all go to the top, and the people, their extraneous wealth would be taxed, and it would not trickle down, it would fly down to the masses, and you would have a minimum level, what they're talking about in European countries now is a minimum guaranteed income or something. That's kind of what Huey Long was talking about back then, that everybody should have shelter and the basic necessities of life. And there's no reason in this land of plenty, as he talked about then, there's so much wealth in this country, there's no reason for any American to be homeless or starving or anything like that. It's just inexcusable.
So how do we achieve this, drastically reduce this economic disparity? Does it begin with tariffs? I mean, even Lincoln warned against abandoning a tariff system. Before we got rid of tariffs, there was no income tax. I mean, that sounds like a good place to start.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, unfortunately, the reason you need tariffs is because of the bad trade deals that have happened in the past. There has to be some reason for people to buy American products, but tariffs are really meaningless unless you bring production back to America, because you can price foreign goods, and then people are just going to be paying more for the goods that are manufactured everywhere else. So you have to have things manufactured here. And until we bring industry back, you know, that's not going to happen. But you're right. We didn't have an income tax until 1913, and because the government was so much smaller. And back then, you know, we would need to completely overturn what society has become in the last 100 years. We would need to have families living together. We would need to have families taking care of the elderly as they used to. That kind of thing. 3 generations of family living in the same home and things like that. Which you're starting to actually see because of economic necessity. You're probably going to see more of that. But would have to go back to that, because that's what happened. People took, families took care of each other. The churches did a lot more work back then and so forth before all these government programs. But the government programs have obviously not worked. They've been completely inefficient, and that's why I said, you know, I think a populist program like Huey Long was talking about was just, it's just simply taking the wealth where it is. And I would like to see a year of Jubilee. You know, I don't see it
sure.
was a
very biblical
tradition.
Absolutely.
In the Bible, but no Christian leader, none of those preachers talk about it. It's one part of the Bible they ignore like the plague. I think we're long overdue for that. Just imagine absolving people of their debts, what it would do. Now, it would obviously hurt the banks and the corporations, but, you know, it's about time they sacrificed instead of constantly asking people to sacrifice who don't have anything left to sacrifice.
All right, let's go back to the phones. A wild card again. Mary Alice is in Los Angeles. Mary, good morning and welcome.
Thank you. Listen, I'd like to bring up two or three things. First of all, I'd like to bring up the role of the court in this creation of this divide between rich and poor. I myself have experienced, I'm living off $720 a month. I have a college education, a master's. The problem was that I married, and when I ended up in court because, unfortunately, my husband forged millions of dollars in my name. I won U.S. federal court verdicts, never could enforce them because the court was against me, the state court, and the money was all offshore. And I know I'm not the only one because I've been studying it. I've even gone to law school so that I can speak and protect myself. But I ended up homeless with my children. Now, I'd like to bring that up, the disintegration of the family and the court's role in impoverishing long-time stay-at-home mothers who, actually, it was my money. The other thing I'd like to bring up is private family foundations in which they're established to keep and ensure the money, and they appoint a family member, and it's just a guarantee of money. And one more, I guess I mentioned the banks offshore, but I think this fact of the court and the family court role, we know that the courts reflect society, and what they do and how we treat the least is determines our culture and our society. And I can assure you, having been involved in Wall Street and having been associated with people, and I do mean at the very top, people you have mentioned, I have sat at dinner tables and I have seen people who ran for president of the United States laugh at the poor who voted for them.
All right, Mary Alice, thank you for that poignant call. Did you have any comments to add, Donald?
Well, I certainly feel for her, and I wish her the best. And unfortunately, I think those are stories like that happening all across America. And she's certainly, I'm no fan of the courts. I had a whole chapter on that in Hidden History. The court system is just one of the many obstacles everybody, everybody in that 80% needs to overcome, because justice, like all rules and standards in our society, is only for the poor. When the rich go into court, I have a whole section on the double standards of justice. I mean, the prisons are full of poor people. There aren't any rich people in prison. If they, on the rare occasions they're convicted of anything, they go to country club prisons, and it's not the same experience. So it's, she's certainly right about that. The court system is rigged like everything else is against the common people and the poor.
I've long maintained that talking about government programs, which really do very little, the only two programs a person needs in his life is a good, stable family life and a good job. And if he or she has that, they can decide for themselves how to spend their money, and they don't need the government to tell them how to do that. But so much of what the government does, and much of it is well-meaning, I think, going back again to a lot of these welfare programs that came up during LBJ's time, leads to the dissolution of family. And so on the one hand, they're breaking up, you know, that one essential program in everyone's life, and then they try to undo it on the other end by throwing money at the problem. It's just nonsensical. All right, let's go back to the phones and say hello to Edward on the wildcard line. He's in Wyckoff, New Jersey. Good morning, Edward.
I wonder if you have considered the biggest land grab in history. It is the property tax. Nobody is talking about this. There is the strangest national silence over the biggest scandal in American history. It exceeds all 28 causes of the American Revolution. We have a Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights 4 prohibits the unreasonable seizure of property. Any tax upon your home is an unreasonable seizure. It transfers the ownership of the home to the taxer without a deed. They have absolute control over you and your home, and you cannot change it. In New Jersey, where I am, the entire state was divided up, cut up into pieces of blocks and lots, and for the purposes of taxes, and created a class structure of two classes, the feudal overlords and the violated tax serfs. This is worse than anything that happened in medieval times. My question to you, what can we do? I mean, I would talk with you at length about what I have been doing. I have been living with this problem for 15 years. Our legislators at all levels, local, county, state, federal, are the causes of this. They ignore us. And as far as I am concerned, silence is an incrimination for guilt. They are all guilty. How can we overthrow them?
All right, Edward, thank you for that. Donald, I mean, there are a lot of people that are tax poor. They can't get out from under it.
Well, you're right, and certainly personal property taxes. Keep going back to Huey Long. Huey Long eliminated personal property taxes for virtually everyone very wealthy in Louisiana. So he's exactly right. I mean, you shouldn't have to pay the government for those kind of things. But you know, recently we've seen how Donald Trump and his administration refused to go against what I think is another real crime is that the way police, the legal system is allowed to. Just snatch property from people, mostly through drug deals and so forth. And it's ridiculous. Even when a person's considered innocent, their car may be gone, their other personal possessions, it's reprehensible. So the government, this is the problem we have. We have a government that has such overreaching powers and is in every aspect of our lives, but provides very little services in return for the incredible taxes we pay and for the incredible power we give it. So we have the worst of both worlds. We have we pay for a socialist state, but we get in return this hard, you know, individualistic libertarian chic that doesn't return any services. So we're doing it completely backwards. And I lay it all in the hands of the leaders. We have some awful leadership. There's such a mix of corruption and incompetence there that the caller asked, how can we overthrow it? It's the system is so corrupt at this point, from top to bottom. It's very hard to figure out what can be done.
All right. We will resume this conversation and take additional calls with Don Jeffries, Survival of the Richest. Here is Eliza Doolittle taking us into the break with Pack Up. Ah, and this is Kim Carnes and Crazy in the Night. I resemble that remark. I want to thank David Brewer, who just emailed me and solved a very long mystery for me. I've long wondered whatever happened to Marie Queenie Lyons, who is just an absolutely fabulous vocalist from about 1970 and then just disappeared. Well, David Brewer has solved the mystery. She opened, she moved to Ashtabula, Ohio, and she's opened a place there called Queenie's Lounge. Marie Queenie Lyons is the queen of Ashtabula soul and funk. To be honest, there's not a lot of competition for that title. We're not aware of any other soul singers from that relatively small town in the northeast corner of Ohio. Certainly none who recorded for King Records. That's the name of the label. Even if she was from a larger, more soulful place, the quality of her few recordings would still deserve a title. Amen to that. Marie was not born in Ashtabula, but moved there as a child with her family to be closer to other family members. She started performing as a teen in local clubs, primarily in the Geneva-on-the-Lake area. She recorded her first 45 in Louisville for the Sims label, a Nashville label that has ties to Cincinnati and Louisville around 1966. 3 years later, after touring with King Curtis and performing in the region with James Brown, J.B. got her connected with King Records, where she recorded an LP of hard-hitting funk and soul. That's what I'm talking about. The LP and 345s got a little action, mainly in the southwest Ohio area, but were not enough to keep her recording career afloat. She settled down in Ashtabula and opened a bar called Queenie's, which is still open at this writing, 2014, and she is still active. Well, I might have to get myself down there and say hello to Marie Queenie Lyons. All right, we will resume our lively and poignant conversation with Don Jeffries, author of Survival of the Richest, and your calls. I won't forget your calls, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And we are into the home stretch with Donald Jeffries, Survival of the Richest. Before we get back to the calls, what happens to all of these good intentions? I believe that most politicians, they get into public office because they want to do something for the ordinary man. But it's almost like, and we talked about Donald Trump, and there was so much hope, and it's still early. It hasn't been 100 days yet. Although I'm beginning to suspect part of the problem is he surrounded himself very early on with people who were not populists, people who are in fact globalists, and whether that was a poor judgment on his part or whether it was intentional, I don't know. But they seem to have his ear now, hence the recent airstrike in Syria. But is there someone, standing in the shadows in the Oval Office when the newly minted president walks in there with all these good intentions? He gets a tap on the shoulder, and this person says, "Now let me tell you how it's really going to go down." Is that, I mean, am I being too conspiratorial, or what happens to these good intentions?
Well, I think what is happening so far with Trump proves that maybe proven conclusively once and for all that one person can make a difference right now. The swamp is draining him. He's surrounding himself with globalists. There's not any outsider there at all. And if someone like that, a rogue billionaire, can't do it, then I don't know who can. I think there are obviously powerful forces in the shadows and that we don't know necessarily. Certainly we see the advisors around him are the same kind of suspects that we get in every administration. And I think it's half or three-quarters of his cabinet came from Goldman Sachs, for crying out loud. So you know you're not going to get much change that way because he's getting consistently bad advice. Now, he ought to be intelligent enough to forego that advice and realize it's bad. But no one's seen, I think JFK was the last president that we had that actually opted for peace and had an independent streak, and we saw what happened to him. So as the caller said, I'm optimistic about what can be done, unfortunately. There's a lot that needs to be done, but you would need a giant vacuum cleaner really to just vacuum out so much of this leadership at all levels, because there are good and honest people within the system, but they're just so outnumbered by the people that have power and wield it unfairly and unjustly and conspiratorially that they really can't get anything done.
All right. Wayne is in Harvey, Illinois. Wayne, good morning.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. Great show, Richard. And thank you for your guests. Thank you for all your work.
Thank you, Wayne. Good to have you aboard.
Yes. What I want to say is at first they had it at 400, and then 80, and then 62. But the real number is 8. It's 8 men with more wealth than the bottom 50% of the world's population. It comes to $426 billion. Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Jeff Bezos, Carlos Slim, Mexico, Mark Zuckerberg, Michael Bloomberg, and there's a man named Amancio Ortega. He has a multinational retail company. What I want to say is I don't think there's any way to stop this except for two ways. The first way is campaign finance reform. We must remove money from politics. And the second thing is everywhere we live in each individual state, you have to get a list of all the politicians of your state, and you have to actually follow how they vote. Because if you don't follow how they vote, that's how they get away with things. That's how the wealthy buy them off to make the laws to keep on taking money away from American people, sucking the money out of the system all the way up to the top. So that's the only way, really.
All right, Wayne, thank you for that.
Thank
your
you.
Your comments, Donald.
Yeah, well, it's what I would suggest is that, you know, in lieu of anything else that we can do, assuming they count the votes, which I'm not at all sure they're being counted, honestly, but, you know, we go ahead and do our civic duty and hope they are, vote against all incumbents. There are a few good incumbents in there, but right now a good rule of thumb is to vote against incumbents. And if you vote against, if instead of having a 96% reelection rate every election, if we had a 96% turnover rate, you'd start seeing the career politicians would vanish. And they'd have to realize, well, you know, I've got to get something done while I'm here. They're not going to be able to enrich themselves at the public trial. So you might see some action there. But as long as you have these career-entrenched politicians, nothing's going to change because they make a career out of this and they get very rich doing it.
Joshua is in Nevada City. Joshua, good morning. Welcome.
Yeah, hi. You guys are awesome. The work you're doing for this book is amazing. So what I want to quickly get to is... In 2001, I believe it was, when the Twin Towers came crashing down, I received a whole bunch of emails, and it was talking about, it was kind of like somewhat conspiratorial that there was some type of an act. It was called the NASARA Act. Are you familiar with this thing called the NASARA Act? It stands for National Economic Stabilization and Recovery Act.
No, I don't.
I'm not familiar with the acronym, but I am familiar with it's like a team that's in place to prevent the economy from crashing.
The emails I got were saying that it was more like what your guest has been talking about. It was having to do with redistributing the wealth, because basically our whole society is kind of getting out of control, is what the act was coming from. And it was like a group of people with some politicians, I guess, had gotten together and had created this NASARA Act, and they were working on it, and they were trying to, you know, get it through Congress and stuff. And then the Twin Towers fell, and what they said is all of the information and everything having to do with the NASARA Act was in an office in one of the Twin Towers. And they were saying that it just added into the whole conspiracy. So I was just curious if anybody even knows or remembers the NASARA Act.
No, that's a new one. What I was trying to remember was called the Plunge Protection Team. But
no,
I'm not familiar with NASARA.
A whole long chapter on 9/11. So there's certainly a lot of crazy stuff that went on there, and I certainly don't believe the official story. But I'm really not familiar with the exact thing that he's talking about.
It might be worth looking up, you know, just because it was a real thing. I looked up it. They had a website and everything talking about what the ultimate goal was, and it all collapsed after 9/11.
All right. Let's see. Who do we have next? Thank you for that, Joshua. Jocelyn is, I love saying this name. I never get tired of it, Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Jocelyn, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Richard. You're my favorite host. In fact, I only listen when you're on.
Oh, God bless you. Thank you for that.
Everything that Donald Jeffries has said, I totally agree with. I'm a senior citizen, and I grew up in California and moved to Wisconsin about 40 years ago, and... just things are not getting better. We're destroying the planet slowly but surely. And all the cruelty that goes on towards each other. I mean, it all fits together. These people, I mean, I heard the other day on the radio that they're taking over these silos, these super rich people, where they'll live if there's some kind of bomb dropped. It's just... Years ago in the middle 60s, I knew some people that were called helmsmen, and they drove around on their route with their little musical trucks, and they sold bakery cigarettes and whatever. And they could, at that time, afford a house. The man I knew had his own house, you know, and the family and everything.
That's right.
I mean, it's just, it seems unsolvable because they control everything and everyone. The only way I can see out, and they would kill millions of people, is if there was a revolution, like Bernie Sanders said. But even Bernie Sanders can't pass a... I didn't realize that Huey Long was such a... I really don't know that much about him. I knew he was from Louisiana and that he was assassinated, but I didn't know that he was that much of a hero for the common man. And I just, I don't know, I feel so sad the way humanity is. You know, I mean, it just, the greed is, it seems like it. These billionaires, they never have enough money. What is it? I just don't understand humanity anymore. It makes me ashamed to be human, to tell you the truth.
Well, listen, Donald, we have to give people some hope and some optimism here. We can't have poor Jocelyn in Sheboygan going away feeling so despondent. I mean, what can we do? I mean, you mentioned obviously voting out incumbents and so forth. Maybe it isn't to be done at the ballot box. Maybe we have to just forget about the politicians and the government and look to our own devices. How do we empower people to start their own businesses and not rely on government?
Well, I think she brought up a good point about people not caring for each other. I think that's where it starts. It's easier to have this kind of unfair system when even at the lower levels, people don't care very much. There's very little empathy. A few years ago, you saw during a Black Friday sale, a guy collapsed and dropped dead in a Target store, and no one tried to help him. They just stepped over his body, and I think that's indicative of the way we've become. And so I think a first step would be to start caring about each other. When you see somebody homeless, at least show empathy, at the very least. And obviously, you know, people who, when you can lend a helping hand, it's a good thing to do. And I wouldn't suggest you give it to big charities. I have a whole chapter on the charities in Hidden History where most of them have such high overhead that it doesn't get to the people that you want to help. Help people individually. You can at least be kind to your family members, your extended family, people that aren't doing well. You know, lend them a helping hand. I think you can start. You know, charity begins at home. You know, if you get your own house in order and you're kind to your own family, your own close friends, you know, I think, because there's so many hard luck stories out there. So many people that are struggling financially. And I think the least we can do is understand that, because we could be in that same boat ourselves. And it's, you know, we're all, most of us are a couple of paychecks away from, bankruptcy, you know, really, to be honest with you. So, we ought to realize that our fellow man, we should try to help them whenever we can.
Absolutely. Amen to that. East of the Rockies, Scott is in Mount Prospect, Illinois. Good morning, Scott, and welcome. Oh, we just lost Scott. All right, let's go west of the Rockies. Alex is in somewhere in the Golden State of California. Alex, good morning. Welcome.
Oh, hello. I'm a longtime listener. First-time caller.
Thank you for that.
I've been thinking about this problem for decades, and I think I got the solution. It's something that they're afraid of very much. You never hear about it. It's called direct democracy. And you get rid of the politicians, and not by revolution, but by evolution, because these rotten politicians aren't worth one drop of innocent blood to be spilled over them. So they bring back the good old American thing about tarring and feathering. You tar and feather them, and you have a rail, you know, slick with shit, and you put them on the rail. And
all right, Alex, it's still a family show, even at this early hour in the morning, so we have to be careful with the language. But I got your message there. Let me see if I can squeeze Chris in, because he or she is calling all the way from Sydney, Australia. First-time caller. Chris, welcome.
G'day, Richard. How are you?
Hi there.
Yeah, it's been a long time since we've spoken. I spoke to you on the conspiracy show.
Ah, right, right. Great to hear from you, Chris.
Years ago.
Wonderful.
Years ago.
We just got about a minute here, so.
I was just going to start. I was going to say, remember, in this revolution, we are also the means of consumption, not just production. But acknowledging your guest with the charity industry was brought up recently again on No Agenda. I think it was No Agenda Podcast 902, and that was shortly after Trump announced the refugee ban. And you wonder, was it genuine concern at these people's welfare, or was it the income that they receive from the UN and from the various organisations that they're making? It's a multi-billion-dollar business. But one thing that's not mentioned, I have never heard anybody mention this outside of my late father, is insurance companies. Now, since certainly as long as I can remember, they've been pushing, since the 80s definitely, they've been pushing this risk mitigation. So for themselves, where they write the rules, they set the standards, and then they take the influences to build up the standards for compliance and for training. And that's obviously used to reduce their risk, used to reduce their need to pay out, because they just say, oh, well, you didn't meet this standard, or this person wasn't doing this, therefore we're not paying this out. And
Chris,
that...
I'm sorry to cut you short there. I mean, it's a great point. Obviously, insurance companies are making a lot of hay these days. Listen, last word to you, Donald, and then we'll tell people once again how they can get your book.
Okay, well, it's the point about insurance companies. In many cases, they're just kind of an unnecessary middleman. They are part of the problem, I think. You can get my book. I hope people will look into this. It's a subject that's very important, and no one has talked about it really the way I've talked, that I'm going to talk about it in this book since Huey Long, since the 1930s. They can get Survival of the Richest published by Skyhorse Publishing. They can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, many internet outlets. So if you Google it, you'll find lots of places. It'll be in the bookstores sometime after. It will be available in July, but pre-orders are always welcome, because it shows active interest in the book, and it hopefully will have a groundswell, and we can make a lot of people read it and understand what the issue is.
Donald, thank you so much. I've enjoyed our conversation once again.
Thank you very much for having me.
Don Jeffries. That's it. We are done. For George Norrie, George Knapp, Lisa Lyons, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galante, Chris Burrows, Lex Lonehood, Nathan Staten, and Donna Walker here in Toronto, Nathan Smith, Scotty Guest, and Jackie Lamport. I'm Richard Serrett. Thank you for your ears and your voices, your beautiful voices. Until next time, so long for now.